Start the recording. And temporarily put everybody on mute, although you're welcome to unmute yourselves. And what else do I need to do? I've already spotlighted the video. We've started the recording, so I need to share a screen. One second. Okay. You good? All right. I'm hoping my goal for tonight is to kind of pull together a couple of loose ends and wrap up this major discussion about this mashal of, that Natan presents to David. And there are two outstanding questions. We spend some time talking about what Natan's intention was and how it fit the story of David and Uriah in various components. And we talked about the Kivsei Shalem Arbatayim and why the declaration of Ben Mavata Ish, connected to this professional thief called the Baba Machteret. And we spent a number we had some discussions. The last two issues that I want to raise, one very briefly and one for the bulk of today's shiur. The first issue is we've identified three out of the four major players in this mashal. We've identified who the Rash and the Ashir are, correct? So who's in the mashal that Natan uses, who is the Ashir? The Ashir is, of course, David, who has got many wives. And the Rash is, of course, Uriah, who has one wife, Bathsheba, and that's the one wife that David manages to take. And so the mashal to the kivsa, which is that the kivsa achat ktana, right? One little ulam, that's all he has, and that's the one that the ish takes. So that's two of the pieces. Of course, the kivsa itself is Bathsheba. And the last remaining variable that we haven't really discussed is the helech, right? This guest. Vayevo helech le'isha ashir. It all starts because this helech comes and the ashir wants to provide food for this helech, like Avram Avinu, who prepares food for the traveling, you know, the three people that he sees traveling by. So too, this ashir wants to prepare food for the helech. And doesn't want to have to waste a large flock from his own herd. And so ve'ikachet kivsata ish harash, he takes the kivsa ve'yasel ish habaylav, and he prepares it for this man who has come to him, this oreach, this guest, this helach, this traveler. So who is this helach? Right? He plays a large role in the story. Who or what does he represent? That's the question. And it's a question that the Mefarshim struggle with because it doesn't actually fit neatly into the story. The story is essentially between three major players, namely David, Uriah, and Bathsheba. So who's the Ish HaRash? Who's the Helach in this context? So difficult is this question that the Abarbanel takes the approach to suggest that nomar shebao hadvarim ela kulam liyapot mashal, that this is nothing more than a literary device that the Navi used to kind of fill in the missing pieces of the mashal. Mashal, this has to be some context for the story. And so he kind of invents this traveler who doesn't really fit the background of the story in order to match to create a plot that would enable this all to begin. I'm not sure that is a satisfactory answer or a satisfying answer, but nonetheless, I think it's a reflection of how difficult this question is. Rashi quotes a alternative view, which is based on a Gemara in Sukkah. The language of the Gemara and Sukkah is very similar to that of Rashi, so I just left it here for you to see it in the language of Rashi itself. Rashi says, Actually, let's do it this way. Let's pull up. Let's put it this way. It's the power of online mikvaot gedolot. What you can do today on the computer, once upon a time, was unheard of. Who is this helech? Who is referred to in three different ways. He's referred to as a helech, a traveler, from the word lalechet. He's referred to as the guest comes to his house. So So if you look carefully at this pasuk, it's an interesting pasuk because it identifies this same person, this traveler, in three different ways. Helech, traveler, oreach, guest, and ish. So Chazal were particularly sensitive to language in Tanakh. Quote the following, Rashi quotes it here on the page. Vayevo helech, dima et yetzer hara. This is a mashal, a parable, says Rashi, based on the Gemara, to the yetzer hara. And it's the yetzer hara that is being portrayed as the traveler, as the guest, that is driving the Ish harash to take the kibsa from the balabai, from Urya, from the Ish harash. Dimad yetzahara tchila lehelach. Initially, this yetzahara is referred to as a helach, a traveler. Shovel etako happens to be traveling by. It's not a particularly significant presence. However, as time moves on, vechakach l'oreach. That same Yetzirah is then described half a phrase later as a guest. Shenasa achsanoi. It has become a household guest by the balabayit. V'achakach l'ish. And then it transforms into the ish, referring to shehu balabayit, which is like now this Yetzirah has become the balabayit. Meaning, what Chazal are picking up on is the fact that the more you allow the Yetzer Hara to take, grab hold, to take a presence, and the more you succumb to its power, the greater it will be, the greater the force and the greater the draw it will have on you. In other words, the more you get hooked into his tentacles, the more you will be ensnared by him. This is a concept the Chazal referred to a lot in the Gemara, and Sukkah is actually a length, it's a whole Amud of Gemara discussing what the Yetzer Hara is, who and what this Yetzer Hara is, and the notion that the Yetzer Hara ensnares by enticing slowly, but then as it begins to draw you in, you get more and more captured in its operation, similar to the phrase that we find by Cain. When Cain is first vexed by the offering that Hevel brings, so there's a pasuk that says that God comes to Cain and says to him that lepetach atat ravetz, that sin is crouching at the door, and you have an opportunity to overcome it, to overpower it, and if not, uyim sholbach, it will rule over you. And the notion that the more you allow it to take hold, the more difficult it will be to explicate yourself from its grasp. And that's exactly what is reflected in the story of David, right? Initially, his connection to Bathsheba is, and the Malbim and other Mefarshim explain exactly that this Mashal fits the story of Bathsheba as the Yetzer Hara so beautifully, because initially, that's exactly what happens to David. David's initial relationship with Bathsheba was what we would refer to in today's vernacular as a one-night stand. It was a momentary weakness on David's part. But as he enables himself, or as he deludes himself into the process of self-justification, he gets more and more ensnared in attempt to cover it up, in an attempt to trap or to engage with Urya, and then Urya's issues and Urya's rebellion. So he causes Urya to he judges Urya's Morad B'Malchus, and he has Urya killed, and then he goes to marry Bathsheba. Like, the more he goes through the story, the more David gets trapped in this, to the point where by the time we're done, that's exactly what David says to him. To when Natan says to David, he says to him after he proclaims Ataish, he's not even worried about the one night stand or the initial night that they had together that started the whole thing. Because by that point, the Eretz Zahar was nothing more than a helach. It was a traveler. But by the time we get into the depths of the story, now you've committed murder and you've married his wife. Now you're dealing with the Balabite. Now this Eretz Zahar has full control over you and what you are. So from a Parshanut perspective, or from a Drash perspective, I should say, this is a very powerful interpretation, this Yetzirah. From a Pshat perspective, however, it's a difficult interpretation for the simple reason that the Yetzirah as a concept, a personification, if you will, is a purely rabbinic literary device, meaning there is no place in all of Tanakh where Tanakh deals with the question of the subject of the Eitz Hara as a personification, as anthropomorphization. What Chazal do when they talk about the Eitz Hara as a conversation between you and your conscience, if you will. The Eitz Hara here as a Ish and as an Oreach and as a Helach, that's purely in the language of Chazal in the Gemara. The Gemara makes perfect sense. The Gemara is discussing the issue of temptation and chet, and therefore the role of the Eretz Zahara. So it uses a kind of an asmach that uses the story of David as that example. But to flip it around and to turn that into the pshat of the perek is very difficult, because it would be out of character with all of Tanakh. There's no other place in all of Tanakh where there's any reference to this concept of the Eretz Zahara as a voice that carries on a conversation with us in our heads. It just doesn't exist. So from a Pshat perspective, it's a difficult interpretation to process. That leaves us with two options, neither one of which is particularly satisfying, namely the Eitz Ahara on the one hand, Chazal's interpretation, or a kind of literary device to add substance to this Mashal without really having a parallel in the story of David. So share with you a possibility, and again, in the Mefarshim, those are the two answers that we have. The one additional possibility, which Rav Medan writes in his Sefer, I share with you. I'm not sure which is particularly stronger than the other, but I think it has a compelling quality to it. And that is that if we've identified three out of the four people in the Mashal, namely the Rash, the Ashir, and the Kivsa, David, Urya, and Bathsheba, the mystery is who's the Helach? Well, in the context of the story of the Mashal, the Helach is the context that drives all of the bad decisions of the Ish HaRash, correct? This Helach is the reason why the Ish HaRash, sorry, by the Ashir, accuses takes the Kivsa and takes him away from the Ashir and has the Ashir killed, right? All of this is driven by this Helach. Well, there is one more personality in the story that itself that we have discussed and that may fit at least in part the role of this Helach, and that is the unborn child. And if you remember our discussion, we had suggested that it was the unborn child that drove many of the decisions that David made, that David took in his poor decisions, because of his concern for the once he hears that Bathsheba's pregnant, everything he does is driven by this connection he has to this child and his desire to have Uriah go back home, and his desire to have, then when Uriah commits treason, his desire to have Uriah killed, and his desire to ultimately marry Bathsheba. All of this is not driven by the Yetzer Hara, according to what we suggested, but rather driven by a real substantive connection that he feels to this unborn child, and to make sure that this child is actually born. He doesn't know anything about it, but the moment he hears about it, that drives his call to Uriah back from the battlefield, that drives his insistence that Uriah go home, that drives his decision to marry Bathsheba. Everything is driven by this unborn child. And in that perspective, the text presents to us a kind of contrast between David's love or connection to this unborn child for no rational reason other than his own subconscious desire to have an heir, to have a child who will be an heir to this, to his kingdom. And on the other side, Uriah's love for Bathsheba, which is presented here in very dramatic terms. Right, the emotional connection between Uriah, between the Rash and the Kivsa, between Uriah and Bathsheba, is compared to the casual connection between the Ashir and the Helach, as kind of to present to us with two options. Okay, whose love is greater? Whose connection is greater? The connection of the Rash, the poor man to his wife, to his Kivsa, versus the Ashir to this traveler, to this Helach. And if his Helach is the Ubar, is the unborn child, then suddenly it becomes another component or another piece of the critique of David, that all of this was done for what essentially was nothing more than a casual relationship, if any, and for that you destroyed the relationship that the Rash had with his wife. So I present that to you as a third alternative. The Yetzer Hara is one option, the literary device is the other, and this is a possible third option, which I think is probably, in my opinion, I think a little bit closer to the pshat of the story itself, helps us understand another depth of the details. All right, that's part one. Part two is much more dramatic and much more complicated. Because the last remaining question is probably the most vexing. If you read Pasuk Gimel and you listen to Natan's words, "V'larash ein kol ki im kivsa achat ktana," the poor man is nothing except one little ewe lamb, "asher kana," who he acquired, and he grew up with, and he raised her, "vatigdalimon," she grew up with him, together with his children, "mipitotochal," she ate of his bread, "mikosotishte," she drank of his cup, "uvechekotishkav," and she lay in his bosom, "vatihilokivat," and she was like a daughter to him. Which, by the way, leads the Abarbanel to suggest that Bathsheba was much younger than Uriah, which wouldn't be very logical in the context of how marriages were done in the time of Tanakh. You have Yitzchak and Rivka, you have Yaakov and Rachel and Leah. It's not uncommon at all to have marriages of husbands and wives who are generations apart, Mordechai and Esther, and initially raising them like a daughter, and then eventually that relationship shifts to a husband-wife relationship, and eventually, as time goes on, the relationship shifts again to where the wife becomes almost like a mother caring for the... Oh, it's all part of the sociological structure of marriage in the time of Tanakh. It's one of the reasons why you have this many times where it was very common for husbands to be a generation older than their wives. for that very reason. It was part of the sociological structure of how people dealt with old age, right? How people dealt with people of with care. Right? The children would take care of the mother would take care of the husband. It was a kind of a process that was very common in time of Tanakh. So it's possible that but that Uriah is certainly older, right? He's a colleague of David, and Bathsheba is much younger. That is not, it's not the same as in today's world, where age difference is a very different connotation in today's society. But in Tanakh, it was very common and it was very normal. But certainly this Vatilo Kevat was like a daughter, is a remez, that Bat is a bayit by Megillat Esther. When Mordechai adopts Esther as Vatilo Kevat, like a daughter, Chazal say immediately Vatilo Kebayit, that she was his wife. But that there was a generation difference between them, and that eventually that was the relationship that was going to develop. So the problem with Pasuk Gimel is, I don't know of any way to read Pasuk Gimel and hear sheep. Meaning, when you read Pasuk Gimel and you tell me that you don't hear that this is a mashal for a husband and wife, I think it's self-explanatory that this, right, up until this point, when Natan is speaking to David, he tells him a story about two people in the city. One has a lot of flock and the other does not. One is wealthy, one is poor. Up until this point, you could theoretically be talking literally. But the moment Natan begins to describe this poor man and this kivsa, who's drinking out of his cup and who's lying in his bosom, I don't know. I have a hard time thinking that literally that this is about a sheep. And yet David's response is so angry and his language is so directed from Parshat Mishpatim at Kivsa Yishleim Arba'atayim fourfold, because it's a case of the killing of the lamb or of an ox, Arba Chamesh. How does David miss that this is about a keves, that this is not about a keves, that this is about an isha, that this is about Bathsheba? In other words, Mimanashach, if David thinks this is about a sheep and he takes the story literally, I think he's a little foolish. Because I think any one of us could figure out that this is about a woman, not about a kivsa, that this is a mashal. And if he understands that this is a mashal, then how on earth does he miss that this is about him and Bathsheba? It's so self-explanatory. David, Uriah, Bathsheba, and the child. Ashir, Rash, Kivsa, Helech. And we're literally within the week that the child is born. It's not even the child hasn't reached, hasn't had his bris yet. So within a couple of months of the story, how thick does David have to be to miss that this is about him? To the point where, after he declares at the Kivsa Yishleim Arba'atayim that he has to be that Ben Mavata Ish, that man should be put to death, and the Kivsa Ish should pay back fourfold, he's signing his own death sentence. And suddenly, I didn't know, I didn't see, I didn't hear, I did not. What are you, blind, deaf, and dumb? What are you, how do you not see that this is about you? Has that question not bothered us since the beginning of the story? How does David miss that this is about him and Uriah? The end of the day, if we don't have a satisfactory answer to this question, we're left with a gaping hole in our understanding of the story.
David was pretty full of himself, wasn't he?
Not really. David is accused of many things. David is not perfect, but arrogant is not one of them. On the contrary, confronted finally by this moment, and his response is atai, is chatati l'Hashem. His response is a lifetime of tshuva. Arrogance is not part of David's sort of character profile. It's very complicated.
But he thought he had gotten away with it.
True. He thought he got away with it. That is
sorry.
True. That's okay.
Do you think that...
He thought he got away with it. But a couple of months later, Natan comes to him and he says, here's the story. What do you think? Okay. He's sitting there with Bathsheba on his throne.
For one, do you think that he knew that they had that Uriah cared about his wife? Because she didn't even want to go to her.
I'm assuming that, that's a lot of conjecture. I think there's some conjecture, there's some truth to a conjecture, but there's a lot of conjecture. That's part of David's self-justification. But at the end of the Navi comes to him and he says, Ashir, Rash, Kivsa, etc. It doesn't take much to figure out what he's talking about. And the giveaway is B'chikot Ishkav. So we're left with a mystery.
Do you think that this contributes to this mashal contributes to the reason that God didn't allow David to build the temple?
No. That's already from before. David is already told that he can't build the temple before he even sees Bathsheba. I think that's connected to the story of Michal. Michal is a driving factor in his need for another wife. That it's indirectly, but not direct. So we're left with a mystery.
Maybe he feels more strongly. Wasn't he like a shepherd? Maybe he feels more strongly about sheep than about women. And that's
he's the king of Israel. It's been a long time since he's been a shepherd of flock of sheep. He's been a shepherd of people for a lot longer.
He doesn't really have any close relationships with the women, right?
That's not true. He was very close with his wives. I mean, Michal is unfortunately a tragedy in his lifetime. But I'm going to leave this as a question. I'm going to pose an answer, share with you a possibility. It's a possibility which I think is very plausible in David's mind. It's not what Natan intended, at least not directly. In other words, what I'm going to suggest to you tonight is that there's two levels of interpretation in this story. There's the interpretation that Natan intended, which is exactly as we played it out. The Ashir is David, the Rash is Uriah, the Kivsa is Bathsheba, the Helech is the Ubar. That's the level at which Natan intended this mashal to be presented, presents it to David. But Natan uses a language that, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and I think intentionally, triggers in David a very different response. And what I mean by that is the following. This use of the word rash for the poor man is odd. Why is it odd? Because if I were to say to you, what's the opposite of an ashir in Tanakh? What would you tell me?
Ani.
An ani.
Ani or avyon. Correct. What? The use of the word rash as a poor man is very uncommon. It's not never, and it is used, but it's not the common usage. However,
isn't it from like noise, like Roshan or something?
No. That's with an I. This Rash, Resh, Shin is a word for poor man. So the question is it used in a particularly conspicuous place? And the answer is yes. The Torah uses it to describe a person who's poor, but there's only one individual in Tanakh who is described as a rash. One individual in Tanakh, personality, who describes himself as an Ish Harash, a poor man. And not only is it one person who describes himself as a poor man, he describes himself as a poor man in the context of marriage, which resonates here even more. Who is that mystery individual? Ta-dam.
Is it Yaakov?
Nope. I'll show you exactly who it is. Vayedabru avdei Shaul b'oznei David. I'm going back to Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud-Chet. Vayedabru avdei Shaul b'oznei David. Servants of Shaul spoke to David. Shaul commanded his servants the following. Dabru al David balat. Speak to David secretly. And say to him, Hinei chafetz b'cha ha-melech b'chol avadav ahivucha. Behold, the king is delighted in you, and all of his servants love you. V'yata yitchaten b'melech. Why don't you become the king's son-in-law? Why don't you marry the king's daughter? If you go back a little bit further, you'll see that David, this is Shaul's conspiring to offer David the hand of Michal in marriage, in order that he should then be able to have David killed at the hands of the Plishtim. I'm going to read the whole parak for you in a moment. But I will give David Michal's hand in marriage. Utilu l'mokesh shall be a snare to him, utibu yad plishtim, so that the plishtim will kill him. So Shaul said of to David, okay, you'll be my son-in-law with one of the two, meaning with the second. He wanted to marry Mirav, but Shaul had given Mirav away to Adriel HaMocholati. Go speak to David secretly and say to him, "Why don't you become the king's son-in-law?" So the servants of Shaul spoke to David. They said these things. This is David when he's still the young shepherd who just slew Goliath. Vayomer David responds, "Hanekala be'enichem itchatem b'melech. You think it's such a light thing to become the king's son-in-law? V'anochi ish rash v'nikle. And I am but a poor, lightly esteemed man." So only one person in Tanakh who describes himself as ish rash, and that is David. Now, if David is the ish rash, then this story that we're learning, this mashal, is not about David and Bathsheba at all. So then what's it about? If David is an ish harash, who's the Ashir? David is an ish harash, a poor man, lightly esteemed, because he doesn't have the dowry to be able to marry into the king's family. The king wants a dowry. The king wants you to come marry the king's daughter. You have to come with something to pay for the marriage. So they tell Shaul this, and the king's response was, Vayomer Shaul, great. Kotum ula David. Say to David the following. Ein chayvitz l'melech b'moha. The king doesn't have a desire for dowry. The king doesn't need money. He's got all the money in the world. When does the king need? He needs a warrior. Ki b'me'or lot plishtim l'nakem bo'e v'amelech. Go and bring me 100 foreskins of Philistines and avenge the king's enemies. And then you can marry the king's daughter. And by doing so, Shaul chashav l'apil at David b'yad plishtim. David, Saul thought that he could cause David to fall at the hands of the plishtim. And to marry Michal by paying for her dowry with 100 alot plishtim. So they told this to David, and David said, that I can do. Kill 100 plishtim? That I can do. Vayakom David, vayelechu v'nashav, vayachba plishtim matayim ish. He killed 200 plishtim. Vayavei David et olotehem, v'yimalum l'melech, v'itchatem b'melech, and he fulfilled his obligation, he brought them to the king, and v'yiten lo Shaul et Michal bito li'isha. Oh.
Sounds like he identifies with Ish Rash more than the Ish Ashir.
100%. That's my whole point. Is to David is the Ish Rash. If David is the Ish Rash, Then who's the Ashir? Who is the Ashir who has many, many flock from which to take? And all this poor Ish HaRash wants is one?
Herod Shaul.
Correct. I'm saying, forget here for now. Now we're going back to David in his early years. If David is the Ish HaRash, who's the Ashir? Shaul. Right? Shaul. Shaul has Merav. Shaul has Michal. Shaul has the daughters that David wants to marry. He raised them, he cared for them, right? These are the, in other words, what I'm suggesting, and we're going to go back and read the story in greater detail in a second, is that David lives his life in the shadow of a story in which he has been the victim of the Ashir who took his wives away from him. Let's go back a little bit, okay? I see a lot of confused faces. So let's go back a little bit. There are a lot of confused black squares if I don't see your video. All right, let's go back to Perek Yud Zayin, which is where they first meet. Shaul and David first meet in Perek Yud Zayin. Technically, they meet a Perek earlier, but I'm going to leave that part of the story out for now. Perek Yud Zayin is the story of Goliath. There's a showdown, a standoff between the Philistine army and the Israelite army. The Philistines are on one mountain, and Israel on the other mountain. And this warrior of the Philistines comes out. Goliath, Goliath is his name. He was taller than everybody else, right? He was the tallest of all the warriors. And he was in armor, and fine. He comes and he declares the following, and he says, why should we go to war? You send your best warrior, I'll send our best warrior, which is, of course, me, Bulechem Ish, and if he defeats me, we will surrender. If I defeat him, you'll surrender to us, right? Classic battle of champions, okay? Who is supposed to go fight this battle? Who's the tallest warrior in the people of Israel?
Shaul.
That's why he was chosen. But Shaul is not on the battlefield. Shaul is gripped with fear. And so Shaul stays behind. They were dismayed and afraid. In walks little David. David, ben ish Efrati hazeh, mi bet lechem Yehuda, shmo Yishai. David is, the background to David, I'm going to skip. There's a whole background. David ends up getting sent to the battlefield to bring his older brothers, who are warriors, food and provisions. And he hears, he sees everybody standing there, and he hears the story. And he is confused. He doesn't understand what's going on. Why aren't they fighting? David turns to his the warriors standing there, and he says, what's going to happen to the person who actually manages to defeat this Philistine giant and remove this disgrace from Israel? Give me a plishti ha'arel hazeh. What is this uncircumcised Philistine? He's nothing. He's taunting the armies of God, of the people of God. Why is somebody standing up to him? So the answer is previous pasuk. The person who will defeat this Goliath, Yashrenu Hamelech. The Melech, the king, will make him rich. Osher Gadol, the king is the Ashir. The king has lots of wealth, and the king will bestow that wealth upon whichever warrior manages to fell Goliath. Not only that, the et bitoy tenlo, He'll give him his daughter's hand in marriage, referring this time at this point to his older daughter Merav. David hears this. David volunteers for the mission. Okay, the rest of the parak I'm not going to read because the rest of the parak we know. David manages to defeat Goliath, and I'm going to jump to the end of the parak for a minute. Sorry, next parak. Let's go on to the next parak. Immediately after this, Yonatan gives David his uniform. David becomes a warrior in Shaul's army. Wherever David goes, he is successful. As they return from slaughter, from killing the Philistines, the women come out to dance and to sing songs of victory. And the women are singing. What are they singing? They're singing how Shaul killed thousands and David tens of thousands. If you ask me, it's a little treasonous, but okay, that's what they're singing. David was too young and too engaged in whatever else was going on to realize and to recognize the significance of that song, which eventually led to Shaul accusing David of trying to usurp the throne and accuses David of treason, tries to kill David, and David eventually has to run. The rest of the story, as we know, is history. Shaul was angry. This was terribly vexing to him. David, they gave tens of thousands, and to me only thousands. What are these? You want to take the kingdom from me? Treason. This David is treasonous. Okay. Next day, David comes to collect his reward, which was Merav. Vayomer Shaul David, hinei biti agdala Merav. Okay, I will give you Merav's hand in marriage. But you have to go and prove yourself. Hilachem melchamot Hashem. Go and fight the Plishtim. You go fight the Plishtim and then come back to me. Shaul said in his mind, I'm not going to kill David. That would be silly. I'll let the Plishtim do it for me. And David's response was, I am nothing. I should be, who am I and who is my family that I should be the king's son-in-law? So when came time for David to marry Merav, so what did Shaul do? He pulled a page out of Lavan's book. And he married her off to Adriela Mocholati instead of to David. Okay, Nebuch David is left without his wife, without his claim to what he had fought all those Plishtim for. But the story's not over because Michal loved Shaul. So Shaul said, okay, you know what? Now I have a chance to really kill David. So Shaul offers David a second chance to marry Bishtayim Titchaten Biayom, his second daughter, Michal, if you go and bring me 100 Orlot Plishtim. And David does exactly as he was told. And so he marries Michal. And Nebuch, at this point, Shaul is stuck. He's forced into this moment where he has to give Michal to David, despite the fact that he thinks that David is guilty of treason. The story gets more complicated because the next parak or two, Shaul tries to kill David. And finally, Michal realizes that Shaul is going to kill David unless she does something. And so she enables David to escape. And makes up an excuse that David tried to kill Michal, and that's how he escaped Shaul's men. And so she feeds into the perception that Shaul has that David is guilty of treason. Right? This is just a quick review of Shmuel Aleph, so we kind of get a perspective here. Okay, so what does Shaul do at that point? we don't find out until Perek Chaf Hei. In Perek Chaf Hei, we are told in retrospect that Veshaul Natan et Michal Bito Eshet David lePalti ben Laish Asher Migalim, that when David had fled under the excuse that he had tried to threaten Michal, which is not true, but that was Michal's way of avoiding Shaul's wrath, Shaul took Michal and married her off to Palti ben Laish. Now, Chazal are bothered by that. Why are Chazal bothered by that? Because there's a technical issue, namely?
Adultery.
Adultery, right? How do you marry Michal off when she is already married to Palti ben Laish? Now, the simple pshat of it is that marriage is a less formality in terms of the way we have ketubot and gittin, etc. But the simple explanation is that Shaul accused David of treason, and by accusing David of treason, essentially annulled the marriage. Right? If he's guilty of treason, then there's no marriage to begin with. Chazal have a somewhat different technical explanation, and without getting into the details of it, if you go back to the story of how the betrothal took place. The betrothal took place initially with a promise that if he goes and he kills the Plishtim, he'll marry Shaul's daughter. David came back and says, okay, I fulfilled that obligation. And Shaul says, well, it wasn't really an obligation. You had only had a promise that if you do this, then I will give you the dowry to marry Mirav. That's a what we would call a loan, an IOU, a Mekadosh B'milveh. Mekadosh B'milveh is not really a kiddushin. It's not really a valid marriage. And so I'm not going to allow you to do this. But if you bring me the actual mea or lot plishtim, you can use them as, you'll forgive me, as the kesef kiddushin for a marriage. So he goes and he brings Shaul 100 or lot plishtim, anticipating that that's now the kinyan for this marriage, to which Shaul's response is, Milva uputa itlacha gabai, milva puta daita milve. Shaul pulls a fast one and he says, well, you tried to marry with a loan, and now you try to marry with a 100 olot plishtim. You really intended with a loan, so you really intended to marry Merav, but now you're marrying, so it's not really a marriage. And so Shaul says, technically, I can get away with claiming that this marriage was never a marriage. It's a very complex halachic pilpul, but in the end of the day, Shaul uses it, according to the Gemara, to justify taking Michal and sending her off to marry Palti ben Laish. And in and of itself, that's only part of the story, because at this point, David decides, after Shaul's death, after a civil war, after it's all over and the people want to unite the kingdom finally, and Avner comes to him and he says, let's unite the kingdom of the north and the kingdom of Judah together, and you'll be the king of all of Israel. David says to himself in Shmuel Bet, Perek Yimel, he actually says to Avner, he says, I'll do so, but on one condition. I was promised Michal's hand in marriage. I was promised Michal as the connection back to Shaul, and that would unify the kingdom. So I will be happy to meet you. Let's meet and unite the kingdom. So David's response was, "Tov, ani echvot itcha brit, ach davar achad anichi shoel, lo tireh panai ki im lifnei hebiachat Michal bat Shaul. You bring me Michal, we can discuss. I want to remarry Michal. Only problem is." Little technical problem. Michal was
married
to Palti ben Laish. And David says, "Tnat ishtiyat Michal asher erasti li b'meya orlot plishtim. I betrothed Michal with 100 Philistine forces, meaning I killed 100 plishtim in order to marry Michal. So don't tell me that she's married to somebody else. She was betrothed to me first." So they send to Ishbosheth and they send to Palti ben Laish and they bring Michal from Palti ben Laish. And in fact, Palti ben Laish goes crying after her, alochu vacho achareha, and Avner says to him, shov, go back, this is done. Michal is now going back to Paltim and Laish. And turns out that David is able to remarry Michal. And so the story should theoretically be happily ever after, except for one problem. And that is that we read at the end of Perek Vav, as David is bringing the Aron to Yerushalayim, that Michal is not happy. Bateret HaMelech David mefazez u'mechaker lifnei Hashem. She saw David leaping and dancing and acting in a manner which was inappropriate. Vativez lo b'liba. And she despised him in his heart. She never returns to him. She returns physically. She never returns emotionally. And we talked about this at length, to the point where David's response to her is harsh and essentially severs the relationship between them, so that the perek ends, Michal batshulo ayal yaled ad yomota. Michal never had children from David. That marriage essentially ends. In other words, in David's mind, Michal never returned to her. She may have returned physically, but emotionally and spiritually, his wife was taken from him and slaughtered. Taken away. And now we put the whole story together. The poor David, the Isha Rash, has nothing more than is a loyal servant, is a loyal warrior in Shaul's army. And he'll fight and he puts his life on the line for Shaul HaMelech time and again. Goes to war against the Plishtim, goes to war against Goliath. In a battle where Shaul should be on the battlefield and Shaul is instead in his tents, gripped with fear, David is out on the battlefield fighting for Shaul. And all he asks is for Michal's, for the king's hand, daughter's hand in marriage. Merav, Michal, the king has lots of daughters. He's Ashir with daughters. He only wants one. Then he marries her. And because of some song that the women are singing, David, Shaul turns on him and accuses him falsely of being of insubordination and treason and throws him to the wolves. And steals his one wife, his only kibsa, takes her away from him and gives her to somebody else, to some elach, to some traveler, to some stranger, to Paltim and Laish. And all his life, David has lived with this story, with this shame, and he's swallowed it. He's taken it. Shaul has was rodev him. Shaul tried to pursue him. Shaul tried to kill him. And David said, he's the Mashiach Hashem. He's the anointed of Israel. There's nothing we can do. Can't touch him. Shaul's trying to kill him. David twice has the opportunity to kill Shaul as a rodev. David says, far be it from me to touch Mashiach Hashem, the anointed of God. And all of his frustrations with Michal and with not having an heir to the throne, and he wants to build the Beit HaMikdash, and God says no, because you don't have a bayit, because you don't have an heir, you don't have a child, you don't have anything. You're nothing without a bayit. And so after a long and complex story dealing with Uriah and Bathsheba back and forth, finally he marries Bathsheba and he has a child. And this child is a male child, and this child has potential to be the heir to the throne. And Natan comes to David, and he says the following. My dear David, Shnei Anashim Ayu Be'ir Echad. Once upon a time, there were two men in the city. Echad Ashir, one was very wealthy. He had royalty, he had money, he had a king's treasury, he had daughters, he had everything you can imagine. And one was Ish Rash v'nikle, poor, despised. Lashira yatzon v'bakar, flocks and herds. V'larash, this poor man, ended up with just one thing. One kivsa, one wife. Her name is Michal. Asher kana, there's only one phrase in this pasuk that doesn't fit this story. I will admit to that in advance. when he acquired her, meaning there was a kinyan, Meir Olot Plishtim, he put his life on the line for her. That's the phrase. I'm not sure there's other children involved in the story, but okay. Until the Ishara and the Ashir came, some Pauti Ben Laish guy comes along. He doesn't want to give him one of his other daughters. So he takes the one kifsa out of the hands of this one loyal warrior, poor man who wanted nothing more than to be a loyal servant of the king, to marry Michal. And Michal was taken away. And for years, David has lived with this story in his heart. And when Natan puts it on the table for him, finally, after all these years, David explodes and he lets loose with all of his frustration and his anger that he has kept buried deep inside. Vayomer Natan Chai Hashem ki ben mavet ha'isha sezot. This man deserves to die. That the kivsa yishalem arba'atayim, and to pay for that kivsa fourfold. What does that mean? Well, if it's Shaul, Shaul is already dead. Shaul died on the battlefield, together with who died on the battlefield together with Shaul?
His sons.
Three of his sons. Yishvi, Yonatan, and Malkishua. But who's the fourth son who dies shortly thereafter? Ishbosheth. So by the time we reach this point in the story, Shaul and his four sons have died. And all David has said was, you know what? Now I see it. Natan, now I see it. You're right. Shaul deserved to die, and his four sons were punishment. And to keep saying, Shalem Rabatayim. Because they took Michal, and they took her away, and they killed her. Essentially, they gave it to Palti Ben Laish. That's exactly the context. Natan, you've just drawn it out for me. You've just explained to me why it is that Michal was given to the Helach, to Palti Ben Laish, never came back to me physically. Physically, yes, but emotionally, not. David hears in this story his own pain, years of it, in the hands of Shaul HaMelech. Vayom Natan al David, ata ish. And in two words, Natan has turned David's life upside down. Because this isn't about showing David that this mashal is about him. That's a small part of it. This is much more significant. This is about showing David that he has become a Shaul. That he has done to Uriah what Shaul did to him. David was a warrior in Shaul's army. Uriah was a warrior in David's army. Shaul turned against Shaul because he heard the people accuse David of insubordination and treason and thought that David was guilty of treason. David accuses Uriah of treason. When Shaul and David first meet on the battlefield against the Goliath, everybody's on the battlefield. Where is Shaul, who should be on the battlefield? In his house, in his palace. when David is sitting in the people of Israel are sitting on the doorsteps of Rabbat Bnei Amon, where is David? In his palace. Shaul, what was Shaul's solution for dealing with David? Send him off to war in the hopes that the Philistines will kill him. What did David do to Uriah? Sent him off to war in the hopes that Bnei Amon would kill him. And everything that Shaul did to David, David has now turned around and he's done to Uriah. Ataish, you have become the Shaul. And you have treated Uriah exactly as Shaul treated you. You caused Uriah's death the way Shaul wanted to cause your death at the hands of the Plishtim. And you took his wife the way Shaul took your wife. And now we understand the depth to which this gezeira that David issues, this declaration, then mavataish, the man deserves to die, but kisai shalem arbatayim, and pay for the keves fourfold. David is not declaring in his mind, is not declaring about himself. He's talking about Shaul. Until David turns it up, until Natan turns it upside down. And he says, now it's about you. Now what are you going to do? And that changes the tenor of everything that comes from the rest of this parak and the rest of David's life. Because the rest of David's life, he's going to live in the shadow of these two words, of a retrospect of tshuva and reprocessing of everything that David has done and the mistakes he's made, because he stepped into a model and a role of exactly what he had despised, what he was so angry about his whole life. Of how Shaul had treated him. Robbie, you had a question.
Yes, I want to know, so how does that fit in with why Natan only comes to him after the baby, after the baby is born? How does that fit in with Shaul?
In Natan's mind, whether it's intentionally constructed this way or not, Natan's focus is on Bathsheba. Focus is on the child. Everything David did was about this child. That's why at the end, even after David does tshuva and he says chatati, and Natan says to him, I've accepted your tshuva, chatati la'ashem v'yom Natan, kam Hashem evir chatatcha lo tamut. He says to him, you will not die, because there was two parts of the gzera, right? Ben mavata'ish, the person should die, and the children. So I'll spare your life, but haben ha'ilod lecha mot yamut, but the child will die. That David
kind of sad through. That.
We'll talk about that piece of it as on the next unit. But that's a whole different biblical model. But the extent to which this mashal fits the story of Shaul, whether that's intended by Natan or constructed in such a way as to be intentionally misleading by Natan, unclear. But what you sense of it is, what I think you sense is how much the story of Michal and Shaul's taking Michal and giving Michal away has been buried deep inside David's emotional psyche. And the moment the opportunity comes for this to kind of come out, it explodes. Until Natan turns it around and he says, this isn't about Shaul, this is about you. And suddenly the world's upside down. But it also helps us understand how David kind of fell into this trap of this mashal, and how much it fed a preconceived frame of reference for David, to the point that it completely hides the context of David's own experience with Bathsheba, until Natan kind of clears it out and says, Ata Ish.
Can I ask a question quickly?
You may.
You had said that there was one thing that doesn't fit in with it's this whole...
phrase. There's a phrase in that description of the Kivsa where he talks about that the Kivsa grew up with him and with his children. Oh. And if David is the Isharash, David doesn't have children to grow up with the... I mean, he has children. But, you can live with it. That's not going to... Mm-hmm. It's not going to... It's not the kind of question that can uproot the... challenge the theory.
Thank you.
I find the explanation compelling because it's the only explanation that I've seen to date that helps understand where David falls into, how David falls into this trap. And it really is a trap. I mean, he's ensnared in it until he finally realizes that it's about him and Ata'ish, and then he's shocked into kind of a reevaluation of his world. So with that, we've sort of brought this unit to a close. Our next piece is to move on in Perek Yud Bet, which is the Gezeira and the implication in David's tshuva, and that's sort of the next part of the story. So we will Bezat Hashem start that next week.
Thank you, Yasha Koa. It was worth staying up for, Rabbi.
This is an example of Mida connected Mida.
Yes, very much so. Next week, we should be at the same time as this week. So we should be good with 7:45.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Have a good week.
Thank you.